Hi, everyone. Good morning. My name is Will Heaton with the Council on Foundations, and I just wanted to welcome everyone to our broadband call this afternoon, or this morning for some of you. Before I introduce Andrew Schultz, our Vice President for Public Policy and Government Relations at the Council, I just wanted to give you a couple pieces of information about how the call will operate. First, just so everybody knows, we are recording this call, and we will have this posted on the Council on Foundations Public Philanthropic Partnership website later on this week, as well as the GFAM website, for you to be able to download or send to anybody else that wasn't able to join. And then second, for our question and answer period, if anybody would like to answer a question, at any point during the call, just hit star 1 on your phone, and then once we open up to the question and answer period at roughly around 2 o'clock, the operator will start to open up that queue for questions. For the rest of the time, however, everybody will be on mute just to minimize the amount of background noise. So with that, I want to thank you, and then I will go ahead and just turn the call over to Andrew Schultz.
Well, thank you all for participating in this call. This is the type of convening that illustrates the role that the Council on Foundations plays on behalf of the field of philanthropy to take advantage of what I think many have described as an unprecedented new opportunity to work with an administration that is not only familiar with foundations and the role that we play in solving broader social problems, but is actively eager in pursuing partnerships and input from the sector about those problems that we're collectively working on to solve together. But more importantly than that, I think this call is a good evidence of the important role that foundations themselves play in that work. The number of participants on this call and the interest in addressing the problems of broadband and how to meet the needs of communities is truly the intersection of public, private, and public philanthropic partnerships in a way that's really critical to our nation. And so I thank you all for taking time out of your schedules to be a part of this. The role that the Council seeks to play in these things is to serve as a convener, to help communicate with people, and take advantage of the network of foundations, our members, and our colleagues alike. But we couldn't do this work without just the tremendous expertise and knowledge of our colleague organizations out there, and in particular for today's call, GFAM, and their great work in this area. And so just really before the call kicks off, I want to extend special appreciation to them for their work, for helping us in this substantive area, and all of you for the time and energy you've put into this. So without further ado, thank you all for being on the call, and I'll now turn it over so you can get to the real meat of why you're all here to listen.
Great. So this is Jeff Perlstein from Grantmakers in Film and Electronic Media. Thank you, Will and Andrew, for the great introduction and for hosting this very timely call. So first I want to extend a warm welcome to everyone from Grantmakers in Film and Electronic Media, and thank you for joining us today. GFAM is a membership association of Grantmakers. We're committed to advancing the field of media funding in the public interest. And as many of you know, we serve as a go-to resource for funders who are interested in exploring the many ways that media, technology, and communications can help shift hearts and minds and foster healthier communities and families and move us towards a more equitable and just society. Calls like this one are timely topics. They're just one of the many resources we provide. Our website, gfem.org, is another valuable resource, and I want to encourage you to visit us there to learn about our other ongoing activities. Specifically, for those of you who are in front of a screen right now, I want to encourage you to go to the website, gfem.org. We've created a resources page with a bunch of background materials, one-pagers, and toolkits for today on the topic of today's call that you can look at during the call and also in the days and weeks to come. We hope that will be really helpful to you. So for those of you who are able to go to the website right now, gfem.org, you'd scroll down the front page on the right-hand side under the very robust tag cloud in blue. The first section right under there says an orange policy. That's related to our media policy work. And the first link should say right there, resources, the broadband stimulus, and how funders can address needs of their communities. And as I mentioned, there's a bunch of toolkits and links there for you to do some further exploration. So as the crisis in Haiti, as well as Hurricane Katrina before it, are really vivid examples, that make clear the critical role media and communications can serve as a lifeline of necessary infrastructure. We're also seeing an increasing recognition from across the philanthropic community that the Internet is critical infrastructure for community well-being on a day-to-day basis, whether that's bolstering access to health information services, assisting with employment or the search for affordable housing, certainly learning and education, allowing families to call relatives, whether across the country or internationally, and so much more. And today's call, as mentioned, speaks to a truly unprecedented opportunity to extend this vital infrastructure to all Americans. It's the Federal Broadband Stimulus Program, which was announced last year as part of the administration's broader stimulus package. The program allocates $7.2 billion to build out high-speed Internet service, also known as broadband, specifically to unserved and underserved communities throughout the United States. And it's unprecedented in a number of ways. I want to quickly just mention four that are relevant here. One is the sheer scope of investment. $7.2 billion is a scale we've never before seen from the public sector around this issue and around this infrastructure. Secondly, the focus of the program. It's targeted, as I mentioned, specifically to meeting the needs of unserved and underserved communities, such largely rural communities, but also low-income urban communities. Third is the opportunity for leveraging funds, what's being called the match. It requires a 20% upfront match, money already committed from any proposal, and then the government is going to put in the other 80%. So that's four government dollars for every $1 that either nonprofits or philanthropy is putting into this. So that's quite significant. And fourth is eligibility, who can apply. While there is a significant chunk of the funding earmarked for technical build-out of networks, of infrastructure, there's also a really robust, dedicated portion for what's called community anchor institutions, with an emphasis on nonprofits that can generate activities that engage underserved communities, their constituencies, in making use of these new broadband services and computers and other technology. So these eligible applicants include libraries, schools, hospitals, community centers, a whole range of community-based organizations and nonprofits. With all that said, one aspect of all this that does have precedent is that the application process can be quite challenging and the timeline is tight. For this next and final round of grant making and funding, the deadline is March 15th. The good news is that we have on this call funder colleagues and technical assistance providers and experts who blazed the trail and participated in the first round of funding that wrapped up in December. They're here to share some lessons learned and tips for getting involved in this current round. And they range from those who had lots of experience with the issue and applied directly for funding to those who are initially less familiar but got up to speed quickly and provided technical assistance, convening, and other resources for the grantees to apply directly. So there's a number of ways for funders to engage with this. Lastly, in closing, I want to quote Charles Benton of the Benton Foundation. They've been in the forefront of a lot of this work for many, many years. You'll be hearing from him later briefly, but he has a quote from one of their great resources that's on our resource page. It says, opportunities like this to fundamentally shape the infrastructure that will connect us all for the foreseeable future come along really only once every second or third generation if we're lucky. So just in closing, for my portion, I just want to say that I hope this call is helpful and that you'll contact us so that we can be helpful in seizing this opportunity moving forward. Thanks very much.
This is Jonathan Adelstein. You mind if I butt in for just a moment?
Administrator Adelstein, no. Thank you very, very much for joining, and by all means, take the floor, and we'd love to hear from you for a few minutes.
The only reason I'm doing that, I apologize, I'm at we're doing our first workshop right now, and we're just at a few minutes because we're announcing how this NOFA is going to work and trying to explain it to the public today for the first of 10 workshops we're holding. We're in Portland, Oregon. And what is it exactly you'd like me to address today? What would be most helpful in the few minutes that I have for you?
Mr. Administrator, I think it would be most helpful for all of the callers if you could just kind of give a brief overview of your goals with this second round NOFA and maybe just a little bit of insight about just the best way to approach the NOFA as the deadline comes up on March 15th.
Okay. This is I'm by the way, Jonathan Adelstein, the Administrator of the Rural Utility Service, USDA. I run the program. We just came up with a really dramatic, change in the way we're operating it, so it's much more flexible in the second round than it was in the first round. This is our opportunity to get broadband to places that the market won't go. We're offering a base 75% grant, 25% loan combination, and we give additional incentives for those who come in with a higher loan amount or more equity. So the contribution from a nonprofit would be something that would allow a an organization to fund to score higher, we don't require a match. BTOP requires a 20% match. We do a 100% financing package because we're primarily a rural development bank with a $54 billion loan portfolio, so we're very familiar with providing loan packages. So we can do one-stop shopping. You come to us, we'll do the loan, we'll do the grant. And we are able to go above 75% for areas that need particular help, areas that are high unemployment, low median income, particularly rural or lack of density. So we have a fairly large degree of flexibility compared to what we had in the last round. In the last round, we were unable to basically expend all of our resources because we had a large number of applications that weren't eligible for a number of reasons that we've addressed in the second NOFA. So in this next round, we think we will have addressed the major issues that caused problems in the first round because we have to get these funds out the door. Given the budget constraints in Washington and the desire to reduce the deficit by the Obama administration, I don't think we're going to be seeing another opportunity like this, perhaps ever again, this level of resources for grants for this purpose. So we really need help in making sure we get good applications in the door. We could use help in getting applications from areas that are particularly hard hit in the economy, areas that otherwise might not apply, diversity. We had a very relatively depressing level of diversity in the first round, only 2% of the applications from Native Americans, and we just need to get more of those applications in the door. The problem is that those areas that are, as you can imagine, the greatest need of broadband service, the most deprived, underserved, and poverty-stricken communities, are the very ones that have the hardest time putting a good application together. And so if there's one thing we could use help on the ground, it would be getting good applications from areas that otherwise wouldn't be able to get a good one together, and providing any resources they need to ensure that that they can meet either the match for NCIA or the loan for us, so they can be able to repay that and have the financial stability to be able to support that operation. So we need to look at African-American communities, Latino communities, Native American communities, and make sure they get in, areas that need the help the most. With that, maybe I'll say that, just to wrap up, our goal is to get to places where the largest number of unserved individuals are, to form the basis for rural economic development for years to come, as well as the short-term job stimulus of building these networks in the first place. So that's basically what we're looking for. Appreciate any help you can provide, and happy to answer a question or two or move back to the workshop.
Jonathan, it's Charles Benson here. I have a question for you. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about the role you see between the broadband infrastructure and rural economic development.
We see broadband as being as important as highways were in the past, or rural electrification, which my agency is a former REA. We electrified rural America. And without it, you couldn't see jobs, you couldn't see businesses locate. If the highway passed by a small rural community, just as the railroad did in the previous era, those towns would shrivel and would not be able to thrive. We see broadband as being that essential for economic development going forward. Businesses can't locate there. Commerce can't be conducted. For agricultural applications, there are a number of problems that are presented by a lack of broadband connectivity. So it's fundamental to a community to have this for the long term. We are looking forward to the short-term job creation of getting these networks built. But more importantly, rural development at USDA wants to ensure that we put businesses on top of the broadband networks we build. And those are the ones that will create jobs for years to come, as well as a better quality of life, telemedicine, distance learning, cultural opportunities that make rural areas attractive places to live, because people can have the quality of life of rural America and have access to all of the diverse information that anybody else in the country might have. So that's my short answer.
Great.
Well, Mr. Administrator, I don't want to hold you up from the town hall you're holding out there in Portland, Oregon, but thank you very, very much for joining the call with us to provide that overview of the program, and we appreciate the partnership that your administration and staff have had with the Council on Foundations and GFAM and a lot of our other philanthropic colleagues, and we appreciate your time.
Well, we appreciate you doing this. And just one last word is that this is really the Super Bowl of broadband funding. We're putting out twice as much funding in this round as we did in the first round. Applications are due by March 15th. And we really have to get cracking. If there's going to be things going, you can't wait for a week or two. I mean, we're down to the wire here. A huge amount of money going out the door in very short order. So rare opportunity. And thanks so much for doing this, and thanks for having me.
Definitely, sir. So I guess at this point, then, we're lucky to have Administrator Adelstein from the Rural Utility Service join us amidst that town hall out in Oregon. But Bernadine Joslin, who is the Director of Public Policy and Engagement at the Blandin Foundation, is with us on the line today and to provide a funder perspective about how funders can engage and convene in their communities. And so, Bernadine, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Jeff. Nice to be with you this morning. My remarks are going to be kind of piling on a little bit to what Andrew and Mr. Adelstein said. It was a great setup for my few short comments. The theme of our discussion today is philanthropy's role in creating a connected America. And for the purposes of this conversation, of course, we mean connected pretty literally, connected by broadband capability. But as philanthropists, I think that the word connected can and should be understood metaphorically as well. What I mean by that is that connecting people for the purpose of having conversations that matter is the first important and powerfully catalytic act that our sector can do. Intentional conversations are the first step to collective action. Our story at the Blandin Foundation is that we have a mission of strengthening rural Minnesota communities, especially our home community of Grand Rapids. So we're what we call in the field a place-based foundation. Our focus is community capacity building for community health. I'm talking to you this morning looking out at the Mississippi River. We're in day three of a snowstorm. We've got a lot of snow on the ground. We're about near the headwaters of the Mississippi River in a very rural place. Tasca County has 3,000 square miles. To give you some context, the state of Rhode Island has 1,500 square miles. And we've got 43,000 people here and over 1,000 lakes and lots of trees. We're a very rural place with very sparse population and pine trees, which we have a lot of EAT broadband signals, so there's a lot of challenge to connectivity in our place. As a foundation, we do three things. We give grants, like most foundations, but what makes us unique and that I wanted to kind of share with you today, colleagues from the sector, is we also do leadership training. We build cohorts of leaders that are committed to community empowerment and action through a long-standing community training program. And we are engaged in public policy and engagement. Jeff introduced me as the director of that program. And the purpose of the work we do as a foundation in public policy engagement is to facilitate the building of knowledge, cultivate relationships, and catalyze informed and effective action. So in the theory of change here at our foundation that undergirds all of this work is a formula that we call, it goes like this, framing times social capital times mobilization equals healthy community. So we work about framing, about social capital development, utilization, and mobilization. If anybody's interested, we do have a pretty fully articulated definition of what we mean by quote-unquote healthy communities. There's different aspects to them. Infrastructure and services is clearly one of them. While not all the foundations on the call or in our sector are place-based, most, I think it's fair to say, are focused on some kind of a community, be it communities of interest, communities of affiliation, communities of practice. And so this idea about building the capacity of your community to frame issues, to employ and deploy social capital and mobilize, I think applies across the sector generally. And whereas traditionally foundations in the United States have been engaged in charity, responding to need, increasingly, and we heard about this at the beginning from Andrew, the field in the United States is recognizing the opportunity, and some would even say and have said, indeed, the moral imperative to be engaged in systems change, to help uncover, design, and create conditions that will increase the capacity of people to solve their own problems. You know, it's that old biblical adage about giving people a fish or teaching them to fish. Or I like the metaphor about you can either be on your knees in the basement mopping up the water that's dripped, or you can climb up to the third floor and shut off that leaky faucet. So we think that it's appropriate here at the Blanton Foundation, indeed imperative in our time, in this unique opportunity that we have with our new administration and underscores that, for foundations to step up to this opportunity for building the capacity of our stakeholders, whomever they might be, whatever communities we work in, to solve their own problems. So if your mission is to build the, you know, thinking of the mission of the sector overall, to build the capacity of others to take effective action, whether that be about broadband connectivity, as we're talking today, children, the environment, healthcare, whatever topic, convening is a very powerful act that foundations are uniquely positioned to engage in. And why is that? We can take the long view. Change requires patience and tenacity, most of all tenacity. I used to work in the State Department under George Shultz, and he used to say famously to us, in policy, the last person standing wins. So tenacity is really important, and foundations are well positioned to hold it. So holding the intent, keeping the goal in mind for the long haul is something we can do better than anybody else. And we've got lots of forms of capital to bring to bear beyond our deep pockets and our grant-making ability. Reputational influence, technical assistance, marrying need and curiosity with best practice, all those things foundations can do well. And we can be perceived as being honest brokers. And I want to say just a quick word about that, that it's very tempting, and often people like to aspire to this idea about neutrality. Emmett Carson, who's used to be in our community here in Minneapolis, once inelegantly said, if you're seen as neutral, you're neutered. We struggle a lot with our trustees to underscore the notion that there is no such thing as neutrality. If you're a values-based, mission-based organization, you have, by definition, you're not neutral. But we can, as a sector, aspire to be honest brokers where all constructive points of views are welcome. And we can bring to bear promising practices from other parts of the country or the planet, help people understand the context. So in terms of ARRA, we took our convening role very seriously, and we brought together people and organizations with the mission to build capacity of our communities. And in our case, as Andrew said, we did also apply on behalf of our stakeholders because we recognize the high bar and the high hurdle for small places to apply for and then manage a large federal grant. And if you're interested in the details of our application, Jeff has it linked up there on the site. You can go there. We asked for $4.7 million to do utilization and sustained use across rural Minnesota. But my main message today is that even if you don't have a history of practice in this area, as we do, which embolden us to apply, and even if you're not focused on connectivity in the broadband sense, that the opportunity to, as Andrew suggested, convene people about this opportunity and bring them together to ask to strategize is one that I think is in service to whatever communities it is that we're your mission drives you to serve. And so I guess I'll don't want to overstep my time. I'll leave it at that and stand by for questions later. Thank you.
Bernadine, thank you very, very much for that overview. And just in the interest of time, I'd like to go ahead now and introduce Jill Nishi, who's the Deputy Director of U.S. Libraries for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And she's also going to speak from the funder perspective, but more from the angle of how funders can provide technical assistance for applicants. So, Jill, I'll turn the floor over to you.
Great. Thanks so much. And, again, thanks to GFIM and the Castellan Foundations for creating the space for this dialogue today. I just wanted to just give a brief introduction of why the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is particularly interested in this broadband stimulus opportunity, and then perhaps suggest three or four ways that we as a funding community can be supportive of our grantees. So very briefly, the U.S. Libraries Program at the Gates Foundation is at its core, a technology access program. Our goal is to make sure that all people in this country have access to high-quality computer and Internet access through the nation's public library system. And we really view our effort, as a couple of the speakers mentioned earlier, as a means to an end, meaning that if you can ensure that all people have access to technology, they therefore have access to the educational, economic, and social opportunities that technology provides to all of us. We've been working in this space for the last dozen years. This is the original program of the Gates Foundation. Many of you, we've branched out into a number of different areas, but given our historical roots, it's not surprising that this was the first philanthropic effort that Bill and Melinda took on. So you can imagine our delight when we learned about the availability of a substantial amount of money in the Recovery Act about a year ago last year. As Minister Adelstein mentioned, this really is an unprecedented opportunity of federal money that will probably only happen once in our lifetime. And so for us, we very quickly began thinking about how we could be supportive of our grantee community, which is primarily the public library field. Unlike what the Blandin Foundation did, we are not applying for funding ourselves, but we are attempting to try and put our grantees, our public libraries, in the best possible position to compete for broadband stimulus funds. So I just would like to offer, for those of you who are, thinking about ways to help your grantees, perhaps offer just five, kind of quick ideas on how you might best do that. The first way is to get smart internally. There recently, in the last week, was a new notice of funds availability, or an RFP, that was released by the two administrative agencies, the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, and then, of course, the Rural Utilities Service. Comb through that RFP or that NOFA, get smart about what the criteria is for this upcoming round. And for both the first and the second round, my team spent a lot of time combing through that, trying to get smart, pulling together a list of questions that we had where we could seek clarity. So the first suggestion would be, get smart about the program. The second suggestion is what Bernadine was referring to. Convene your grantees. And whether that be, in person or via conference call or webinar, and share and disseminate, what you're learning. Getting smart is important, but it's only valuable to the field if you pass it along. And I can't underscore, I think, the really important role that funders play, as Bernadine said, in convening our respective fields. The third area is we are providing what I might generically call technical assistance, and that is to provide professional consultant support to our grantees to develop their proposals for both NTIA and RUS. For those of you that are familiar with the NOFAs, it is a quite complex set of application criteria. Fortunately, it has been streamlined in the second round, so it is easier to apply. But nonetheless, for a very small organization, that application process can feel quite daunting. And so what we've done here at the Foundation is made available professional assistance for our grantees to go after those dollars. And to the extent that you can do the same, I think it would be most welcome by the field. The fourth idea, to the extent that you have resources that are available, the NTIA applications do require financial match. It was 20% in the first round. Our understanding is that it has been increased to 30% in the second round. So to the extent that you can provide grant funding for that purpose, I think that's ideal. I think in the eyes of the federal funders, any leverageable funds that can be secured by the applicant are seen as very favorable. So again, the Gates Foundation has, will commit to providing a number of matches to our applicant population. And I will say that for some of the public libraries we are supporting, our support has actually leveraged local community and regional foundation support, which is just is absolutely thrilling to us. And so to the extent that we have local foundations that are on the call today, I would really encourage you to get out, understand who's applying for this money, and your dollars can also be leveraged in the same way. And I know that for all of us in the funding community, that's always something that we're seeking to do. The last suggestion I would have for my colleagues on the call today is while we have resources, we also have our voice. And as Bernadine mentioned, we come with a very credible voice. So we at the foundation have spent quite a bit of time taking on some advocacy work to certainly kind of educate our federal funders on the important role that community institutions are playing in terms of points of public access for people who do not have access to the internet, as well as their growing need to deliver critical services to their community, their growing need for broadband access. And we were very pleased as a result of that advocacy to see a higher emphasis and priority being placed on funding being available to our community institutions. We've also been involved with a coalition, if anybody is interested, of both educational organizations as well as membership organizations and funders who are advocating on behalf of community institutions with our federal government to ensure that a good portion of these stimulus funds do land in their hands, because, again, we think that is the most efficient use of these dollars. So I'll stop there. Look forward to responding to any questions folks have, and just appreciate the opportunity to share some of the work that we've been doing with my colleagues on the call.
Jill, thank you very, very much. What I'd like to do now is introduce Sasha Weinrath, who is the Director of Open Technology Initiative at the New America Foundation. And the Council on Foundations has been working with Sasha over the last few months to provide our membership with technical assistance and just sort of helping us break down and really understand the NOFAs that have been released by the government and have that information distributed to the council membership. And so today, what Sasha is really and his team have been able to do is, since this NOFA was released, have been able to really go through it page by page and really understand what is needed to fill out the application for this next round of funding. So I'm not going to really try to delve into it any more than that, but Sasha, I'd just like to turn the floor over to you, and we appreciate your time.
Thanks, Will. Well, let me start by just explaining a little bit about what the Open Technology Initiative is. We are a group of technologists and engineers and policy analysts that are part of the New America Foundation, which is a large think tank here in D.C. So I like to joke that we're sort of a technology tank inside a think tank. And we were drawn to the broadband stimulus funding due to our work doing a lot of on-the-ground media and community organizing projects. And we saw that broadband was a key element in a lot of this work, and that this was a golden opportunity. I think as both Administrator Adelstein and Charles Benton pointed out, a real once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to move things in a completely different direction. And what we're seeing now is that with round two, with $4.8 billion being allocated over the next few months, that this is both a hell of a lot of money on the one hand that's being given out, but also just a tiny fraction of the amount that we actually need to be spending as a country. And to drive this point home, I like to compare Australia and the U.S., both of which announced broadband stimulus funding initiatives. In the U.S., we had a total of $7.2 billion. In Australia, they've announced $31 billion. And when you break this down per capita, it means that in the U.S. we're spending about $24 per man, woman, and child to Australia's $1,400. And so in many ways, we're looking at the broadband stimulus support as sort of this golden opportunity to fund innovative projects, but also as just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the kind or the amount of support that needs to be generated to support sort of next-generation networking, economic development, and et cetera. And what's being, because it's such a small amount, what's really being focused on by both NTIA and RUS is this notion of holistic models for deploying broadband that are interconnected with a variety of other programs and initiatives, and this maximum leverage, this notion that the more that the community brings to the table when you are going after funding, the more likely you are to have a competitive application. Now, in the first round, it was oversubscribed 10 to 1. And so those are the odds that you will be up against as you put in an application. On the other hand, I'd say about 90% of these applicants only put in the bare minimum matches for this funding. Now, as Adelstein mentioned just a little while ago, this round is a lot more flexible than the first one. The first round had a number of barriers to entry that kept a substantial number of potential applicants out of that funding pool. And it also had a lot of problems in terms of disqualifying specific entities or constituencies that might not fit these sort of rather rigid criteria that were set up. We spent a lot of time after round one pushing on NTIA, us, and a tremendous number of other folks, and RUS to fix those problems. And the end result is that, you know, I think two questions sort of come to mind. One is, you know, what should we be doing right now? And that's, you know, the purpose of this call is to really activate a larger coalition of groups to be involved in this. But the second question then is, what should we be doing next after broadband stimulus? This runs through September of this year, and clearly is inadequate in terms of supporting the large and growing needs throughout our society for connectivity and affordable broadband. So hopefully this then becomes sort of a starting point for a much larger long-term conversation and intervention. And community foundations, philanthropies, et cetera, have a incredibly important role to play in all of this. So for our part, OTI's part, we've been working with a number of different groups. We've been working in Philadelphia and in Detroit and with Native Public Media in Indian Country. We've been building resources for people to look at. We built a Council on Foundations guide for philanthropies that really focuses on some of the areas that all of you may want to look at and hopefully be involved with. We've created NOFA guides. These are guides to the notices of funding availability and when the applications are actually released, and they haven't yet been put into the public domain. But when they do come out, we'll have application guides that run you through every key element, the eligibility criteria, the kinds of documents you need to prepare, time estimates for different roles within that, how much time will you need from engineers versus grant writers versus project managers, et cetera. And we'll come out then also with a strategy memo as well as supporting key projects around the country that we feel are exemplars of the kinds of interventions that should be supported at the highest levels of U.S. policy. So I'll stop there because I think the most important component of all of this is going to be providing resources and answering questions for folks such as yourself so that you get into a place where you're comfortable applying and talking with Administrator Adelstein and others to kind of push the kind of agenda that we would like to see in the United States in terms of affordable, ubiquitous broadband connectivity for everyone.
Sasha, thank you very much for that quick overview, and we'll definitely get to some question and answer period here before long. But before we do that, I'd I'd like to take a real minute here to introduce Charles Benton, who is the chairman and CEO of the Benton Foundation. And he has been a very important part of this entire broadband movement, he and his foundation. And he was also at the council's Rural Philanthropy Conference in Little Rock, Arkansas this past year in July, and was really kind of one of the main catalysts to start this entire broadband conversation here at the Council on Foundations. And for that, we are very, very thankful. So, Mr. Benton, I'd like to turn it over to you, and you have the floor.
Well, thank you very much. Congratulations also to the Council on its task force on communications information technology, which I was privileged to serve on as co-chair of the policy committee. But I think that report of the Council's will help to raise consciousness within the council members on the role and potential of technology for themselves and all of their grantees. And so it's wonderful that the council itself, apart from its affiliate GFEM, which is an important partner here, but it's wonderful the council itself has decided to take a leadership role on technology. I know much more. I don't know whether – have you formally released that report yet? And if so, I think it would be very interesting through Jeff to get that report to all the members, all the people on this call and members on Jeff's list at GFEM.
Actually, Mr. Benton, yes, what we're doing is next week in San Diego at the Council on Foundations Family Philanthropy Conference, we're going to be having a session there specifically dedicated to discuss this report with attendees at that conference. And then we'll also be having similar sessions at the Council's annual conference and also at the Community Foundations conference later on this fall. But in addition to that, that report is also up on the Council's website, and people are able to download that there as well. And we're also happy to definitely share that with GFEM so that they can have it up on their site. But after the Technology Task Force made their presentation to the Council on Foundations Board in their November 2009 meeting, we're taking this next year, 2010, to really share the recommendations of that report with the field and to seek input. So the more insight or comments or suggestions that we can get from our funders throughout the field, the more that we're looking to hear for them, because we want to hear that input to then see what the best plan that we can put forward on behalf of the field will be. And so we can provide that web page with that report and a follow-up email that we can send to all of the participants today.
That's wonderful. That's great. Thanks to the to Bernadine and Jill who gave wonderful reports here, and Sasha for your leadership in both getting information out about and helping to analyze the BTOP information flowing from NTIA and RUS. A question for you, Sasha, that I assume that this strategy memo that you talked about at the end of your comments, that it will be helping to provide further perspective to the application guide, which has not yet been released. Is this the strategy memo that you're working on with Joanne Hovis at NATOA? And perhaps you might give a little bit, if it is, give a little bit more about her background, because she is really well qualified to help you on the strategy memo, in addition to your team that you've got on this.
That's right. So, yes it is. And this grows out of, after the first round NOFIS came out, Joanne and I collaborated on an initial strategy memo that laid out our concerns for this first round of funding and a number of changes that should be made in future rounds. And I'm actually very happy to report that initial strategy memo became sort of the nexus around which a number of different organizations began pushing for changes, and that a substantial number of the requests that we made in that strategy memo for changes were, in the end, adopted by NTIA and RUS. Now, because this is the final round of broadband stimulus funding, we feel that it's really all the more important to be talking about kind of what's next. And Joanne is both the president of CTCNet, which is the the Columbia Telecommunications Consortium, which does analysis and work with municipalities on fiber deployments and et cetera, as well as the president-elect of NATOA, which is the National Association of Telecommunications Officers, and does a lot of work all across the country with municipalities. And the reason why we thought it was really important for us to get together is that, you know, as we think about and, you know, as people talk about we want these holistic solutions, it's very clear that the NGO sector, you know, all of these community organizations should be working with local municipalities and coming up with models for service provision, models for spreading broadband adoption, models for building public computing centers, et cetera, that span traditionally siloed spaces, that it's not about building a municipal-only network, it's not about a public safety network, it's not about a library network, it's about creating, you know, one big tent under which broadband connectivity is spread. And our hope is this second strategy memo then becomes a point for collaborating on pushing policy reforms for, you know, whatever comes after broadband stimulus.
If you could talk about two points in this regard. Number one, the comprehensive communities point that seems to be very much front and center with the NTIA. And number two, the relationship of all this or potential relationship of all this to the Universal Service Fund and its and the push for reform of that fund that we're getting from the FCC. In fact, the chairman of the FCC, is, as some of you may know, has asked for recommendations from staff on universal service reform to come out at the same time as the National Broadband Plan, which is now due out on the 15th of March. It's been extended, or 17th of March, been extended by 1 month. Sasha, if you could talk a little about the comprehensive communities idea, which seems to be very much in vogue at this point, and that the cross-collateralization of the three programs, I think, is the implication. And then as to the future, where universal service funding for broadband might kick in.
Sure thing. Well, we're lucky enough to be joined, actually, by one of my staff, James Losey. He was one of the lead authors on the NOFA applicant or the NOFA guides, and will be also diving into the minutia of the applications and presenting those guides. I think he'd probably be perfectly suited for answering this question on the connected or the comprehensive communities. James, are you there?
I am.
Great. Why don't you take it away?
Now, the cost of a comprehensive communities is something that we've seen in some other countries, such as Japan. And what happens is it's just a core community infrastructure that brings together all the major connectivity needs of a community, such as community anchor institutions, such as the libraries and schools, or the municipal needs, such as the city buildings and your public safety institutions. And that brings the first wave of connectivity in community to get the different institutions working together, connected up online, be able to use that connectivity to provide services. And then, but what happens next is you can start leveraging that connectivity to provide a last mile service because you already have a core backbone that's able to handle a lot of information. And then you can expand that out to use some of that excess connectivity to provide services to people's homes, provide municipal wireless, to provide even things such as telephone services for city workers. Or provide wireless connectivity to police cars and fire engines on the road. So it's really a way of bringing an initial connectivity into the community and then being able to leverage what infrastructure you've initially built to expand on that, whether that we're able to do that with additional funding opportunities from on the federal level, whether cities are going to realize how much value they have in their communities, and they're going to be able to contribute and provide some matching funds so foundations can also provide additional services to the institutions they're working with. but it's really just a great way to maximize how this technology is bringing bonds to communities. And then also, it comes into the need of how we need to reform universal service of being able to recognize that amount of value broadband is going to bring into communities and how it's really going to become what electricity was 100 years ago. It's really going to be what is going to level the playing field for all these underserved communities to be able to get all these social and economic benefits that broadband is able to bring into the communities.
Right. And to add to that, really what we're looking at is these new ways of thinking about holistic projects and comprehensive communities then intersects back with national policy. It's clear that, for example, E-rate reform and universal service reform, but even inter-carrier compensation reform, need to take place in order to support the widespread adoption of these kinds of models, models that we've already seen have worked extremely well overseas and which we're only just beginning to implement here in the United States.
And in fact, the interesting thing is we've got the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity with this $7.2 billion, of which $4.1 is on the table right now. The Universal Service Fund is paid out of, has been paid out of our phone bills, and actually we're spending every year about $7.5 billion in universal service, but mostly it's going to analog telephone and not digital broadband, and that's the big challenge, is how to transition that money from analog telephone to digital broadband. But let's get back to the role of foundations here, and I wonder if, Jeff, you or Sasha has got further ideas for the role of foundations, following up on Bernadine and Jill's excellent comments. What are the priorities for foundations both communicate out to their grantees and mobilize folks around this opportunity, which really is got less than 60 days before us to apply?
And Sasha and Jeff, this is Will at the council. Please go ahead and answer that question, and then what I'd like to do is make sure that we can open it up to questions from our callers, and we'll start that as soon as you finish.
Sure. Well, I see there's sort of two different, levels of effect here. There's the proximal impact that can happen where you support your grantees and organizations within your service communities in order to, provide them with the support they need to apply, in order to educate local constituencies about the opportunity that even exists right now. It's surprising to me how few people actually are paying attention to this funding opportunity or even know of its existence, given that, I think in some ways we are used to knowing about these things, but it's not necessarily where people are looking for support or funding for these kinds of projects. But, as Charles has mentioned, this is a very fast closing window for direct impact. And clearly what needs to happen is it needs to be part of a far more comprehensive plan of action, a far more comprehensive intervention in this space. Coming back to the Australia versus U.S. model, if we just wanted to keep pace with Australia, we wouldn't be spending $7.2 billion. We'd be spending closer to $430 billion. And in that regard, this is a space where, over time, foundations and philanthropies are sort of a sleeping giant in this space. We've seen, for example, Gates has had an enormous impact here in Washington, D.C. circles, simply by helping activate libraries and by weighing in on these issues and by becoming sort of a advocate for universal service and connectivity for these anchor institutions. And that's the kind of, longer-term impact that we need to see, and that's, the potential for meaningful interventions that impact communities across the United States is really quite substantial in that regard.
And this is Jeff. Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. I actually think that's a terrific answer, and would just point people for more discussion to the resources page, where there's some toolkits and recommendations. They can also send me an email offline or contact us at GFAM. But I think it would be great if we got to the questions from the callers.
Terrific. If Sarah, our operator, Sarah, I don't know if we can just go ahead and open up that line and start, and the first person in the queue when they come on, if you could just announce your name and the organization we're with, and then we'll start answering questions.
Sure, if they just want to press star 1 on their telephone, their line will be open. Once again, star 1, please. And we do have our first caller. Please go ahead.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
My name is Dan Stern. I'm calling from the Housing Assistance Council. And I think one of the problems we've run into with our groups is that they're kind of scared of this sort of thing. Like, they don't know what they would possibly do. So what sort of suggestions do you have for an organization kind of trying to reach out and encouraging groups to apply for this funding, even if they don't necessarily know exactly what they would do with it?
I think I might jump in on this one here. I think this is James, the New America Foundation. I think what I would start with is a key thing to do is to raise, from a community foundation perspective, is to raise awareness of the opportunity and take some chances to gather information of what was done the first round, what type of projects can be done. And then when someone comes up and says, we're interested in this funding, we would like to get a grant, but we're not exactly sure what we could do with it, you can help them assess their needs and suggest, based on what they have, what they could do, what the next step could be. It could be a computer, it could be a library or a community center that maybe has one computer, and find a way, well, what could you be doing for your community if you had 5 computers and some staff to help do some training of how to use the computers, how to take advantage of economic opportunities, or to find out which parts of the community aren't connected and which types of institutions could use an infrastructure project, and help work with them, apply the engineering assistance and grant writing assistance to help them really focus on what needs the community have and help them lower the barriers of applying for the grant.
And I would also add, Dan, you know, this is a clear case where the network effects of having multiple collaborators are most strongly felt. Having run several small local nonprofits over the years, I can tell you that none of my groups would have had the capacity to apply alone. And in some ways, that's all the more reason to be looking around within your local community for who are the collaborators that you might hook up with, because not only will it help in terms of making the application more accessible, it will certainly also help create a stronger application in the end.
Let me add, there's a new dimension on the website, the broadband match. Broadband, is it broadband.match or broadbandmatch.us.gov? I'm sure someone can help me on this, but there are 600, 800. There's a number of organizations that are up on that, especially on that website, that have laid out their capabilities and their interest in finding partners to put in an application.
That's right. And James also led an effort to distill the multi-hundred pages of NOFA language into a far more accessible 10 to 20-page document that kind of goes through, in layman's terms, lays out a lot more of, you know, what these things are about, what you need to be looking at in terms of how you can apply, where the priorities are, et cetera. I mean, and I think that alone makes this a lot more accessible to folks that are interested in pursuing or potentially pursuing broadband funding.
Terrific. Can we go to the next question?
Certainly. Caller, your line is open.
Hi, this is Mark Pruner from the Native American Broadband Association. The website is broadbandmatch.gov for people who are interested in the matching area. The other thing I was going to point out is I think these applications are lengthy and time-consuming, and there's a lot of competition for them. But the things we've been talking to people about in the tribes is that it gives you a chance to work together with other people in the community and also to the funds that you spend and the effort that you spend is not wasted, because these plans are very useful going forward. So whether you get funded in this round, where, you know, to be blunt, the odds are against you. They're, the subscription was 7 times or 100 to 1 on what might be funded on the first round. But the application will be very useful going forward. So we think it's something very valuable to do now, and we think the National Broadband Plan will provide additional funding in the future, as will E-Rate.
This is Jeff Burlstein. Just want to mention that that Broadband Match website is up on the resources page that we refer folks to. Again, that's at dfem.org. You scroll down the page on the right-hand side. Under policy, it says resources right there.
Terrific. Thanks, Jeff. Can we go to the next question then, please?
Yes, and once again, it is star one, please.
Yeah, this is Jeff Klein at Self-Reliance Foundation, and you may have already answered it. It's just, where do we, is there one place that people can go to get all these resources and links that you're suggesting? Is it in the resources section of GFEM, or is there anywhere else that we can refer people to go to?
Jeff, this is Will Heaton, I'm sorry, at the Council on Foundations. And I would say definitely GFEM's website is one of the best places to go. Their resources page has a lot of that information. Also, the Council on Foundations website, underneath our public policy section, there is a link to an entire broadband resources page as well, and one of those links is actually to the GFEM page. But we also have several links to a lot of the Sasha Meinrath and his group's strategy papers and application guides and whatnot as well. And I think sort of those are kind of the two best one-stop shop websites that you can use to then sort of branch out and find other links depending on what type of information you're looking for.
Sorry,
Bill, I hope you've got the Benton Foundation on there, too, because we have that broadband toolkit, which we did for round one and will be revised now for round two. So the broadband toolkit for foundations as another resource. So I hope you've got the Benton Foundation up there and your website as well.
It should be. I'll make sure after the call is done, though, that we do have a link to that website.
Wonderful. Thank you.
So there's the Benton Foundation, and there's the GFEM, there's the Castellan Foundations, and what's this about Sasha? What's his group? What's the link there?
Sasha, I guess if you wanted to explain a little bit again briefly about your group.
Sure. Well, we're creating a number of different resources that are, in use by a number of different groups. We've created, again, this 8-page sort of overview for Council on Foundations, which contains links to a lot of these things, I believe was sent out to everyone on the call, but if not, will be soon. But we've also got a number of strategy guides. We have, you know, our own resources up at newamerica.net/broadbandstimulus. That's newamerica.net/broadbandstimulus. But I think, you know, all of these sites, and this is where I think the real potential and power of these collaborations, all of these sites interlink to one another. So if you can get onto any of them, if you go to GFEM, if you go to Council on Foundations, you'll be able to link through to all these other sites that people are mentioning.
Okay. Yes, that's what I would, this is Jeff. I would just echo that and just say, yes, we do have the Benton toolkit up there. We have the toolkit that Sasha just mentioned they put out on our site. And just to help people navigate to how to find that page, again, you go to our main page, dfem.org. You scroll down the front page a bit under the tag cloud on the right-hand side, and right under the section that says policy in orange, it's the first link. It says resources, the broadband stimulus, and how funders can address the needs of their communities.
Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you, Jeff, Sasha, Mr. Benton. Can we go to the next caller, please?
There are no further questions at this time, but once again, it is star one.
If I could just add to all of this, you know, I think it's very easy to get fixated on the first order impacts here in terms of everyone's interested in the funding itself. But what we're finding is perhaps even more important is activating local communities, getting communities organized and thinking about how to collaborate in new ways, using, in essence, this funding opportunity as a way to build capacity within the local community around these issues. And that in many ways may end up being even more important than the particular project that you're going after. And then sort of the tertiary area would then be sort of long-term systemic regulatory and policy changes, interventions, you know, as a part of, for example, the National Broadband Plan that will be coming out, or as a part of further interventions or further funding support for innovative projects in this area. All three of those areas, I think, are really important, and not getting caught up on just the first, the immediate funding from NTIA and RUS, I think is also equally important.
Well, communications capacity building is fundamental to everything we do. I mean, really, so that's the argument, I think. And insofar as foundations are understanding that, we'll see a lot happening in the near immediate future.
And we do have one more question over the phone.
Terrific. Thank you.
Hi, this is Alice Myatt from Grantmakers in Film and Electronic Media, and I want to thank all of the speakers who participated today. And I just wanted to underscore the importance of using this as a community-building tool. One of the things that we're hearing back from folks who submitted to the first round, and whether or not they received funding, they felt that the projects that they created and the alliances that they formed were important enough to continue whether or not they received federal funding. And the funders at the local level agreed and are putting resources behind it because they do see it as a community-strengthening activity. So I just wanted to remind everyone, very often we turn down proposals, but we know that the value of it, what was proposed is very, very important. And there are a number of collaborations on the BTOP and BIP sites of things that did not happen, but will give you ideas to foster in your respective communities. So I just wanted to add that. Thanks so much.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Alice. Are there any more questions in the queue?
Not at this time.
Okay. Well, before we sign off, Bernadine or Jill, do you have anything that you'd like to say before we end the call?
This is Jill. I'll just, echo my thanks to my colleagues, both who listened in as well as those that participated today. Again, I would just underscore the point that was made that, you know, part of this is looking at the longer-term perspective. And while in the short run there is this opportunity to secure this unprecedented amount of money that's available, I think there is lots of value in the partnerships that are being built as a result of this process, as well as some of the long-term planning that I know certainly is occurring in the library field. And so to the extent that folks can see this as an opportunity to forward, you know, longer-term downstream goals, this process can actually be very, very valuable. So, again, short-term and long-term are both important perspectives as we think about broadband and the role it plays in all of the work that we do.
Terrific. Thank you, Jill. And I think Bernadine had to sign off. But before we finish up, Sasha, is there anything that you'd like to close with, or Mr. Benton?
Thank you so much for doing the call.
I would just add that, you know, most of us that are working in this space are highly accessible and happy to talk with you, answer questions, point you in the direction of experts and resources, and that you should feel free to contact myself or my team. Probably I'll even volunteer the other folks that presented on this call as resources that can be tapped if you're looking for ways to get involved in this or have follow-ups to this conversation.
Terrific. Well, before we close, I just wanted to say thank you to all of our speakers today, and I really appreciate the time that everybody's taken to spend with us. And just as a reminder, the two sites, obviously GFEM and their website, has a number of different links and resources that you're able to use. And the Council on Foundations, their website, our specific webpage that where you can access a lot of the same information about the broadband is just ppp.cof.org. And on there is where you can find our technology task force report, links to the Benton Foundation and other foundations as well. And so feel free to also email us at the partnership@cof.org email address if you have any other further questions as well. And if we don't have it here, we definitely will be able to find the people that can answer your questions. With that, though, I would like to thank everybody for joining us today. This is definitely a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity right now with the amount of funding available through the federal government. So please do use us all as resources to move through this application process, and we look forward to working with you. And with that, we'll sign off. Thank you, everybody.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation.